she could say. My name is Ada Sibelius, and my favorite mathematician is Gauss. Finally, she settled on, Hi. Hi, she said. I'm Ada. I'm 13. I'm from Dorchester. Which was, of course, silly. They all were. The math class was so incredibly basic. Ada had had a suspicion it would be, but it was so simple that it was actually interesting to watch, at least at first. Sister Margaret was spending time on the multiplication of fractions, teaching the class in a slow, methodical way, drawing X's from top to bottom and bottom to top. Ada knew to do this intuitively, but it had never been mapped out for her in that way, mechanically. Everything she knew of math was somehow more fluid, more instinctual than the diagrams that Sister Margaret was putting on the board. It felt like someone telling her how to speak, or by what method to put together an intelligible sentence. It felt like someone telling her how to access a memory, how to breathe. And yet, all around her, students were completing exercises given to them by Sister Margaret using the same cross-hatching technique she was demonstrating at the front of the room. She wrote a list of equations on the board and then roamed the room silently as students put their heads down to work at the task. Ada put her briefcase atop her desk and carefully turned the dials into place and sprang the latches with a louder pop than she'd recalled. Several students around her turned to look, and it was then that she noticed the backpacks that were tucked neatly into baskets beneath each student's seat. Red and green and blue canvas bags with straps, the sort that David called satchels. Instantly, her face colored, and she lifted and lowered the lid of her briefcase as quickly as she could, retrieving from it the pad of Steiner Laboratory stationery and the pen her father had tucked into place that morning. Then she pushed the briefcase under her desk. She began to work. After a moment, she felt a presence over her right shoulder, a shadow on the desk.
In this class, we use pencils, said Sister Margaret, more loudly than Ada thought necessary, and graphing paper.
Ada looked up at her. She hovered there disapprovingly, her small mouth turned downward, her hands folded before her. How was I supposed to know this? Ada wanted to ask her. It was a question that had occurred to Ada perhaps 10 times that day already. How was I supposed to know any of this? She felt anger toward her father and Liston in equal measure. Surely, Ada thought, they could have prepared her better than this. A sharp bell signaled the end of the period, and Ada took out her paper schedule to see what was next. English, then history, then physical education, then lunch, then home economics, then something called general science. She wondered what it might be, what they might plan on teaching her in a science course with no specialization. When she looked up again, she realized that every other student, including her ambassador, had left, and new students were coming into the classroom. She scurried out into the hallway and caught a glimpse, at the end of it, of Melanie McCarthy's bright blonde hair, her bright white knee socks as they disappeared around a corner. She ran to catch up, to follow the class to its next destination.
No running!
Came the reprimand from an unknown voice behind her, and she broke her gait, but felt a sort of panic rising inside her. She did not know where A-Hall was. Furthermore, she felt certain that she would cry if she had to ask anyone for help. She thought of her father, how easily he approached strangers, how little hesitation he had when it came to asking for what he needed. She wondered for the first time what he had been like in school. She had never once thought to ask him about it, perhaps because she had no experiences of her own to compare his to. But now she wished she had. Instinctively, she knew that it would be a mistake to talk to anyone. She tucked her briefcase under her right arm and held it tightly there. It felt less conspicuous that way than it did while swinging in her hand.
At last, she reached the end of the hallway and turned right. 30 feet ahead, the rest of her class marched or skipped or slung arms familiarly about each other in a way that made her understand that they had moved through their entire education as one unit, that they knew each other's parents, that they had gone to each other's houses for sleepovers, that they played sports together in and out of school, that they knew each other's embarrassments and victories, and that they had come to terms with all of them, had settled comfortably into groups and clusters and strata that it would take Ada years and years to accurately map. She was the last to arrive in her next class, and in all of her classes for the rest of the day. She gained a new textbook in every class, was instructed by every teacher to cover it in brown paper before the next day. They were bulky, these textbooks. She could fit only one in her briefcase. The rest she carried in the crook of one arm, wishing fruitlessly for the use of her other one. At lunchtime, she walked into the cafeteria and froze. It was then that she realized the extent of the stratification of the lower school, the broad and awkward age range, from 5-year-old kindergartners to 13-year-old 8th graders, some of whom looked as if they might as well be teachers. And within those ages, the boys and girls divided themselves, and within those two genders, they all seemed somehow divided by levels of attractiveness or confidence. She hovered for a moment, and then plunged forward as if into cold water. Briefly, wildly, she scanned the room and saw the angelic head of Melanie McCarthy, wondered if she should approach her, as the only other student she had formerly met. But Melanie was surrounded by other girls sitting shoulder to shoulder on both long benches, as close and tight as matchsticks in a box. Ada found the only empty table she could find, knowing somehow that it was not hers to take, that it belonged to a group that would very likely claim it in a moment. But she had no other options. She sat at the very end of it and took from her briefcase the paper bag that David had handed her that morning, its contents now squashed. After a few moments, the other half of the long table began to fill with boys who looked her age or slightly younger. None of them had been in her morning classes. 7th graders, maybe.
"Nice briefcase," one of them said, with so much force that she imagined everyone in the cafeteria had heard.
Ada glanced over quickly but could not determine which boy it had been. The little group bent forward and backward, felled by their own laughter. She was holding her sandwich halfway to her mouth, and she stiffened there, uncertain how to proceed. She felt endlessly observed. She lowered the sandwich and followed it with her eyes. She had never been so directly targeted before. Once or twice she'd been shouted at by another child on a walk to or from the store, or while going someplace else in the neighborhood. But on those occasions there was always the possibility of disappearance, of walking quickly in the opposite direction, pretending she hadn't heard. Here she was, a stationary target. A sitting duck. She froze, still as a deer, keeping her eyes down, waiting for the tide of humiliation to wash over her and recede.
"Nice briefcase,"
the boy shouted once more, having successfully elicited a laugh from his friends the first time. And Ada saw then that it was a ruddy, freckled boy, quite small for his age. He looked back at her.
"Yeah, you," he said. "I said I like your briefcase. Aren't you going to say thanks?"
Later, when she thought it likely that interest in her had faded, she stood up as quickly as she could, tucked her now hateful briefcase once more under one arm, her textbooks under the other, and asked the only adult she could find where the bathroom was. Then she walked down the hallway, opened the bathroom door, and upon finding it empty, tucked herself into a stall. She set down her stack of textbooks and her briefcase on the floor. A wave of relief washed over her, to be unseen, hidden inside something small, to be totally alone. She stayed there for 20 minutes, checking the digital wristwatch that David had given her, waiting for the bell. She looked at her schedule. she would not be late again. Girls came into and out of the bathroom, holding forth on various subjects in rushed, enthusiastic bursts of language that Ada sometimes didn't understand. She noted their diction with interest, sentence structures she had never heard before, expressions she had only heard in restaurants or on the T. The 1980s marked the dawn of like as a sort of linguistic master key, a shapeless, bendable word that fit into the crevices of sentences as perfectly as honey. The girls at Queen of Angels poured it over their speech greedily, and Ada mouthed it herself in her bathroom stall, practicing along with them as she often did with other members of the lab. At 11:54, when the bathroom was empty, Ada opened her briefcase on her lap. From it, she took the pen, the pad of paper, one textbook, and added them to the pile of textbooks she'd made on the floor. Then she tucked the empty briefcase into the nook between the toilet and the wall. She'd leave it there for the rest of the day. Her books didn't fit into it anyway. She let herself out of the stall and into the hallway once more, carrying her textbooks on her meager hip, and she walked to her next class. At the end of the day, when she returned to the bathroom nearest the cafeteria, she found that the briefcase was gone. She opened every stall door to make sure. She stood for a while, pondering what to do, wondering how she would explain it to David. In the mirror, she looked unlike herself. The foyer of the lower school was crowded with children, all jostling against one another to exit. Outside, she saw in her path a group of older boys from the upper school, some of them so much older that they seemed to her like men, the whole broad-shouldered bunch. They were standing in a group, some of them leaning against the wall of the school, others standing splay-ankled in the middle of the sidewalk. Groups of boys terrified her beyond all measure. Typically, if she saw them ahead of her on any walk, she crossed the street to avoid intersecting with them. But she had turned left out of the school doors, and the street was too busy to cross, and to turn around completely would have made her too visible. She continued, head down, hoping to pass them unnoticed, when she heard her name.
"Ada," said one of them.
She still had her eyes on the ground, and her instinct really was to keep going. But then he said it louder. She was past them already. She clutched her books more tightly to her chest and pivoted slowly on a heel. She could feel a deep, defeating warmth spreading downward from her scalp. She looked up at William Liston.
"Hi," she said,
so quietly that she might as well have mouthed it.
"How was your first day?"
The other boys looked at her, or away. Two of them continued whatever conversation they were having, uninterested.
"Okay,"
she said, trying to produce more volume this time, wondering what anyone else would do or say at this moment. Make a joke, perhaps? Some tossed-off line, some little act of self-deprecation or school deprecation that showed him she belonged. William Liston paused, as if waiting for more.
"Cool,"
he said finally, and then turned back to his group. She understood that she was dismissed. She also understood that something further had been expected of her, a few more conversational twists and turns, and she racked her brain for anything, another word, another phrase. But she was not a native speaker of William's language, of the language of children. Suddenly, from behind her, she heard her name again.
"Ada, there you are,"
called a voice she recognized instantly as her father's. She froze.
"And William Liston," he added.
Ada turned around slowly, nervously, and saw David on the opposite sidewalk wearing the large glasses that had gone out of fashion half a decade before, one half of the collar of his shirt tucked in on itself messily. He did not look to the right before bounding out into the street, and the driver of the car that screeched to a halt in front of him rolled down the car's window to object.
All right, said David, holding up a firm hand in the driver's direction. Let's not overreact.
Ada had told him she would meet him at the lab after school. It had not been the plan for him to come here. All around her, she could hear a ceasing of conversation as her classmates stopped to watch the spectacle of David. His clothes flapping in ways she had never before noticed, his thin frame jangling along, elbows sticking out at odd angles. He reached the sidewalk and waved brightly to William, calling out his name once more, telling him hello.
Hey, said William.
One of his friends turned his back to all of them, presumably to hide his amusement.
You're getting very grown, William,
David called brightly, which caused a physical shudder to make its way from the top of Ada's head to her shins. Then he put one hand on her shoulder.
Was it terrible?
He asked her, too loudly. Ada shook her head no. Her voice was still lost.
Well, how was it? And where's your briefcase, my dear?
David said. A giggle from someplace to her right. She looked down at the giant stack of books she was carrying in her arms and back up at her father.
I lost it, she said slowly.
He regarded her. In his gaze, she saw that he knew what she had done, the intentionality with which she had misplaced the thing, and it shamed her. He would not have cared what anyone said, she thought. And she told herself that perhaps she was not so like him after all. That perhaps she lacked the best parts, the noblest parts of David.
How on earth does one lose a briefcase?
David said at last, and then at last he turned and walked toward home. And Ada followed. Her ears burned at the rumble behind her, of a dozen conversations that resumed in hushed tones with more urgency and the low sounds of laughter that followed. That night, as she fell asleep, she thought about William, the great beauty of him, the way his sinews fit together in a neat, finished puzzle. And she pondered for the first time in her life the particular flaws of David, which she had never before counted or even noticed. And she wondered what other people said about him when she was not there to hear them. From then on, every day, Ada went to school, sat quietly, spoke to no one, waited for her day to end. She longed for the lab, for her work. When no one was watching, she coded on the backs of her book covers until she was caught. At 2:15, she burst forth from the front door and walked as quickly as she could without attracting undue attention to the tea. And then took it to the lab to spend her afternoons there, catching up. Part of her longing to be there was selfish. The work of the lab engaged her in ways that she thought her schoolwork never could. But part of it was out of fear, for David's work was beginning to falter. Now she took copious notes on everything he was tasked with doing. She had always attended meetings alongside him when she felt like it, but now she made a point to, jotting down items as if she were his secretary, his personal assistant. Quietly, she asked him questions, tried to jog his memory, tried to help him keep up with the demands of his position. Has Frank written the abstract for the JACM article? You should get it in by next week. Did you call McCarran back? At night, after quickly completing the homework that Queen of Angels had assigned, she dutifully told Elixir about her day, still eager to feel she was being useful to the lab, still relieved in some way to unburden herself to something safe. And at last, she turned to the work that David had assigned her before his decline. He wrote down assignments for her in marble composition books, the names of pieces of music he wanted her to listen to, the names of proofs he wanted her to solve, books, films, pieces of artwork, even wines that he particularly enjoyed, which he told her she could save for later in her life. As she made her way through them, she derived a sense of satisfaction that far exceeded any she got from the homework the nuns assigned her. One day, she solved at last the Sierpinski proof. She shared this with no one. Next, she read a biography of FDR and one of Winston Churchill and one of Albert Einstein and one of Isadora Duncan. Then 100 Years of Solitude. Then L'Étranger by Camus in French. Julian of Norwich's Revelations of Divine Love. Slowly, and then quickly, David began to seem less and less interested in his research, which had theretofore sustained and engrossed him completely. It was frustrating to him now, to get to the end of a task and not remember the beginning of it, to forget the names of devices and procedures that he used every day. She whispered them to him when she could, but she was not always there to help, and she could tell now that everybody knew. His colleagues began to look at him with sad and nervous eyes. Only Liston treated him normally, with a sort of brusque, business-like vigor that Ada appreciated. In the winter of Ada's first year in school, he disappeared twice more, both times for several hours, both times denying that he had been gone or insisting that he had merely gone for a walk. Where he had gone on his walks, he could not say. They did not go to New York that year for Christmas, nor did they have a Christmas tree. The possibility crossed Ada's mind that David hadn't even gotten her a present until late on Christmas night. She shyly produced hers for him. It was a rare early edition of The Castle of Otranto, a bizarre favorite of David's that she had found in an antique shop nearly a year ago and had been saving ever since. And he sprang to his feet. From upstairs, he produced a wrapped present for her. When she opened it, she saw that it was a sparkly, spangled sweater. And she knew with certainty that it was Liston, not David, who had chosen it, bought it, and wrapped it. By late January, she had stopped leaving him alone. Liston, without being asked, began to pick him up in the morning so that they could travel to the lab together. Ada kept herself awake at night, listening for footsteps descending the stairs, waiting for him to make a noise that would rouse her. She grew weary with fatigue. She grew tired of pretending to the rest of the lab that everything was all right. She hung the front door and the kitchen door with a dozen decorative jingle bells that she'd purchased on sale after Christmas at a nearby store. She rigged up a system that would drop a hammer on a pot when either door was opened and rested slightly easier. Twice her makeshift alarm system sounded in the night, and she bolted from her bed and chased after him down Shawmut Way, guiding him back to his bedroom gently, telling him he was sleepwalking. He was worse at night, or whenever he was tired, less lucid, nearly incapable of intelligent conversation. He called her mother once. Once, he grabbed her by the wrist and placed her hand on his forehead, as if to tell her he had a fever, wordlessly, plaintively. It frightened Ada. He forgot her name completely on several occasions and regularly forgot the names of his colleagues. "That one," he said, or "you know the one." When the DCF agent stopped by, Ada prepped David, subtly, in advance, walking him through the questions Miss O'Brien would ask him by asking him them herself. By the end of their visits, he was tired, cantankerous, unlikable. And Ada would do her best to cheerfully distract Miss O'Brien. Despite all this, he protested that everything was fine.
"I'm perfectly all right, Ada," he said in response to any line of questioning about his memory or emotional state. "Really, I'd be much better if everyone would stop haranguing me constantly."
For months and months, Ada tried to make herself believe that this was true. But at last, in March, shortly after she turned 14, Ada walked into his office at the lab. He was staring down at some paperwork on his desk, but he did not seem to be processing it. When she entered, he looked up at her, blinking.
"Who's this one now?"
he said. She knew then that she could not pretend any longer. She walked resolutely down the hall to Liston's office and knocked on her door and felt her face crumple.
It was all she could do to keep from crying. She hated crying. It felt to her like a failure of will, a hot and humiliating display of weakness. David did not like it when she cried, and she had never once seen him do it. Miraculously, she held in her tears. Liston beckoned Ada toward her and pointed to a seat.
"I'm sorry," Ada said.
Her throat was tight. She hiccuped.
"He needs to see another doctor," said Ada,
though she knew, even then, that there was nothing to be done. The disease was rolling in unstoppably, a powerful foreign front advancing. Liston convinced David to make her his executor shortly after that, when it became clear that the home visits by social services were going badly. Her childhood friend Tom Mira, who worked for the DCF, had warned her. Ada, who had become masterful at eavesdropping in the last year, stood in the upstairs hallway of David's house, the receiver of a telephone extension pressed to her ear, the mouthpiece upended in the air. She breathed as lightly as she could, listening as her father and Liston negotiated her fate. "They'll take Ada away from you," she heard Liston say. "Don't think they won't."
"Really, Liston," said David, protesting.
But in his voice, Ada heard something resigned and anxious.
"It would be best for Ada, David," said Liston. "Right? I mean, wouldn't it?"
And it was then that Ada put the receiver gently down on the table, not wanting to hear any more. She did not know whom to trust. Only later did Ada learn all of the details of their arrangement. Mercifully, that year they attempted to keep her protected from whatever backroom dealings in which the two of them were engaging. Even David, never one to shelter her from the affairs of grown-ups, undertook to baby her just a bit, given the circumstances. Or perhaps more likely, he simply forgot to tell her. But over the course of the following months, it became clear that Liston and David had agreed, whether it was Liston's idea or David's, Ada was never certain, that Liston would be designated Ada's legal guardian in the event that her father became unable to care for her. On April 1st, 1985, David resigned from the Steiner Lab. He did not tell Ada he had done so. She found out only when a grad student let her know that she would really, really miss her father.
"He's just a great guy," said the student earnestly. "A classic. There's not many like him anymore."
A week later, they received an invitation to a retirement party, formally worded, to be held in a ballroom at the Bit. President McCarran was listed as the host, a fact that made David, even in his somewhat incapacitated state, scoff. Peter McCarran, who had replaced President Pierce several years prior, was despised by David for reasons Ada never fully understood. McCarran was a short, rough man, quite unlike his stately predecessor. He was pushy and red-faced, a bulldog, good at fundraising, but bad at math.
"That idiot," David said,
any time his name was raised.
"Good old McCarran," he said now, ruefully, more slowly than he might have before. "He probably couldn't wait to see me go."
The dinner itself was on a Friday night, David's last official day of work. Ada was to meet him at the lab that afternoon after her school day ended. In the morning, David came downstairs in an unironed button-down shirt, and Ada pleaded with him to go back upstairs and put on a suit. She herself ran home briefly after school to change out of her school uniform and into a dress that was slightly too small for her, a pretty one that Liston had helped her pick out the summer before, on one of the shopping trips she sometimes orchestrated for Ada, to David's mild disgust. The dress, made of light yellow cotton, was too summery for April, and to compensate, Ada had paired it with black tights, black patent leather shoes, and a blue ski parka, her only winter jacket.
She had hoped to do without it, but it was still cold that April, and it would not warm up for a month. She looked odd. Even she knew it. But she had few other options. She ran to the tea through a chilly rain. Inside, she produced the piece of paper she had been carrying in her pocket all day. This was her secret. At Liston's urging, she had composed a speech in her father's honor, a description of his career, the awards he'd won, the impact he'd had on his field. She had stayed up late every night that week, working in her bedroom with one light on, neglecting the homework her teachers at Queen of Angels had assigned her. "My father, David Sebelius," it began, "is retiring after nearly 30 years of running the Steiner Laboratory." She had crafted it carefully to emphasize his great accomplishments, the nobility of his character, while keeping it relatively restrained and dignified. She had tried to make it funny. If there was one thing David hated, she knew it was sentimentality. When she reached the lab, she went straight to Liston's office.
"Don't you look pretty?" said Liston, standing up from behind her desk, taking off the reading glasses she needed but professed to hate.
She too had dressed up for David's dinner. She was wearing an oversized pink blazer that both clashed with and set off her hair, and she had applied more blush than usual. She was wearing big dangly earrings in geometrical shapes. She would be the one assuming David's role as head of the lab. She looked as if she had attempted to dress in a way that reflected her promotion, but even Ada knew she had gotten it slightly wrong. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 hours before the dinner was set to begin. Shyly, Ada produced from her pocket the speech she had written and asked if Liston would mind looking at it. Then she sat down on the beanbag chair that she had slept in often as a child and stared at the floor and waited anxiously for Liston to respond.
"Oh, Ada," Liston said, "I think it's perfect."
When she looked up, Ada saw that little pools of tears were hovering precariously above Liston's lower lashes, threatening to spill over. Liston smiled briefly and then let her face drop. Ada studied her. She was a pretty woman, 43 that year, slightly plump, soft-featured. To Ada, she looked perpetually like a teenager. Ada had never been privy to the dressing table rituals and ministrations of women. She mistook Liston's fashion sense, her dyed red hair, the mascara she wore, for signifiers of youth.
"I'm sorry," said Liston, and she let out a sad little laugh. "I'll just miss having you here, that's all. Both of you."
All 6 colleagues filed out, one at a time from the main room of the Steiner lab. Charles Robert, and then Liston, and then Frank, and then Hayato, and then David. Ada left last, and placing a hand on the wall behind her, she tapped the light switch down instinctively, without having to search for it. She looked backward, into the darkened office, and it felt, in a way, as if she were leaving her life and her body behind. As if, when she closed the door behind her, she would become a ghost. Something spectral and disincarnate. Something without a home. She wondered if this was what David felt like all the time. She wondered what would happen next. The dinner was held in the faculty dining room of the BIT, which had been decorated with linens and flowers. David had already declined to speak, and so he settled uncomfortably down into his chair at the table that had been reserved for the 6 of them, along with the provost, President McCarran, and Mrs. McCarran, a tidy woman who tried to make polite small talk with David until, at last, she gave up hope. David's posture was slumped. His head hung low. When people spoke to him, he did not meet their gaze, but turned his own to hover someplace around their mouths, as if trying to read their lips. He did not eat until he was reminded to by Ada.
He smiled politely as one after another, his colleagues at the BIT, and some from other institutions, spoke about his achievements and intelligence, his wit and generosity. But the naming of these qualities was, to Ada, only a cruel reminder of their recent disappearance. David got tired easily now. Once or twice his eyes closed completely, and Ada jostled him as subtly as she could. Ada was due to speak last. She felt in the pocket of her coat, which she had insisted on hanging over the back of her chair for her speech. The paper by then was soft with the wear of being handled, being worried over. She produced it and put it in her lap, glanced down at it when she could. But as dessert was being served, and while the provost was speaking, David turned to her and asked, too loudly, if she was ready to leave. Ada shook her head once, quickly. President McCarran had heard him. Ada was not certain how much the rest of the university knew about the reasons for his retirement. Certainly the other members of the lab were protective enough of David not to have said too much to anyone. But in that moment she realized that everyone must have known that something was wrong with her father.
"Come now, Ada," said David. "Really, let's go."
Politely, McCarran averted his gaze. Ada leaned toward him and whispered to him urgently. "It's for you," she said. "The dinner is for you. We can't leave yet." David was shaking his head slowly, as if he had not heard her.
"I've got to go," he said,
and unsteadily he stood up from his chair. He held a hand up to the rest of the table.
"Okay," he said. "Bye to all now."
Ada stood up too. She wanted to reach out to him, to pull him forcibly back by his elbow, but she felt that that would be worse. Her speech fell from her lap onto the floor, and she bent to retrieve it. Without meaning to, she caught Liston's eye as she rose, and on her face Ada saw such a look of sadness, such pity, that she quickly turned away. Together, she and David left through a side door, and behind her, Ada heard the provost stutter, and then pause.
"Well," he said, "I guess our guest of honor is indisposed."
Then they were outside, and they stood together for a while on the sidewalk while Ada decided what to do next. The rain had stopped, but it was bitterly cold. Too cold for April. "Can we take a cab?" Ada asked, something that David abhorred. To him, taxis were for the lazy, the fiscally irresponsible. But she thought it was worth asking, for she was shivering even in her ski parka. And that night, he immediately agreed. In the taxi, Ada was silent, furious. She said nothing except to give the driver directions when David failed to. David rested his head against the headrest, closing his eyes for a while. She looked over at him resentfully. In the yellow light from storefronts and street lamps, he looked sickly and old. She had been noticing lately that his physical size was shrinking. Although he had always been thin, he had seemed shorter recently, more stooped, as if he had aged 5 years in a week. His eyes had dark circles beneath them. She supposed he had been handsome once. His stature had helped him to be so. He was uncommonly old when she'd been born, yes, but he'd always seemed young for his years. He was tall and well-built, at least, with fine features and bright, inquisitive eyes. When he felt like it, he was capable of listening intently for hours on end. Women had always liked him. Ada was not oblivious to this fact. But he was changed now. More like a grandfather than a father. Someone incapable of offering her protection. She felt unsteady and unsafe. At home, Ada retreated to her room without saying goodnight. She turned on her computer, pulled Elixir up to have a talk. And then she heard the sound of David's footsteps on the stairs, heard a faint knock on her door. It was rare for David to come into her room. She had no memories of him sitting on the edge of her bed, reading her a story as she drifted to sleep. Though he read to her, it was always downstairs in the living room, in a somewhat businesslike manner, she sitting in one chair, he in another. And when she tired, Ada would trot upstairs and put herself to bed. At 4 years old, she knew how to brush her teeth, wash her face, comb her hair so it would not tangle. She knew how to don her nightgown, to tuck her little body into bed. Now she went to her bedroom door and opened it a crack. She was still wearing her ridiculous outfit, banana-colored dress, heavy black tights. David looked distressed. The light in the hallway was off. She could see him only in the light cast upon him by her little desk lamp.
"May I come in, Ada?" he said.
She opened the door a bit more. There was only one chair in her room, at her desk. David claimed this, so she sat down on her twin bed across from him. He looked at her seriously.
"I want to apologize," he said.
Ada was silent.
"I've spent a great deal of time denying what's become undeniable recently," he continued. "That my mind is most certainly being taken from me, slowly. This is a truth that I have found it difficult to confront."
She looked at him. She felt recalcitrant, unswayed.
"I can tell you're upset." "While I have my wits about me," said David, "while I am relatively mentally intact, I want to tell you what it has meant to me to have you as my daughter, Ada. You cannot imagine." "Now," he said, holding up one hand to stop her as she opened her mouth to speak. "Now, it is true that great innovations in the field of medical research and technology are becoming..." He trailed off, looking down at his palms, as if wishing for notes.
"Innovations in medicine and technology?" said Ada.
"Yes," said David. "There is a chance that some intervention will occur in my lifetime that will reverse the course of what I now see as my inevitable decline. A small and improbable chance, but a chance nonetheless. That said, I don't think you should cling to this hope. Because, as we both must accept, the likeliest course of events is that I will die before you've reached adulthood. And therefore, that is my prediction, and that is the path for which you should prepare yourself."
Ada nodded. She was sitting very still on her bed. She was still wearing her coat. Her right hand was in her pocket, grasping the speech she had written about her father. She wondered whether she should give it to him.
"It is also possible," said David, "that you will one day learn some things about me that are difficult to understand. I think every child goes through this process. The problem is that I will not be here, perhaps mentally, perhaps physically, to explain them to you, or to guide you through them. And therefore, you must trust me when I say that everything I have done has been out of a wish for a better life for myself and for you. And everything I have done has been in our best interest. All right, Ada?" She didn't move. She watched him. His gaze was beseeching. He leaned forward in his chair to look at her. "Do you understand?" he asked her.
And at last, she nodded. Though at that time, she did not.
"Finally, I have never been a religious man," said David. "But I also have some notion that this is not the conclusion of our story, my dear. I think it quite possible that our paths may cross again someday, whatever that may look like."
Thank you for listening, said David. He stood up, somewhat painfully, and walked to the door.
I'll miss talking with you most, he said,
and then he was gone. They never spoke this way again. After much consideration, Ada did not give him the speech she had prepared for him, thinking that he would deem it too maudlin. Instead, she kept it for herself, reading it occasionally to remind herself, as her father declined, of how he used to be. The morning after David's retirement was an odd one. It was a Saturday, and there was no reason to leave the house. No lab to go to, even if they had wanted to. David was quite still, and sat with a book of poetry near the windows at the front of the house, not really reading.
At last, some free time, he said, feigning cheer. I've been meaning to get to this for years.
Ada made a lunch for both of them of pickled herring sandwiches on white bread, his favorite, and cut them into dainty crustless bites and served them with strong tea. Afterward, she begged him to walk to the library with her, simply for something to do, and he agreed. He looked at the librarian, Anna Holmes, without much recognition, even though she had worked there for years and called him by name, and even though Ada had once wondered idly whether the two of them might have crushes on one another.
How are you, David?
Asked Miss Holmes, clearly happy to see him.
It's been so long.
David looked at her quizzically.
Quite well, he said. Thank you for asking.
Later, Ada read and worked on problems until it was time for dinner and bed, where she prayed without much faith or conviction for the healing of her father, thinking of Julian of Norwich, of Franny Glass. Sunday was much the same. And then, on Monday, it was time to go back to school. Ada admonished her father not to leave the house. Their exterior doors, original to the house, could be locked with an old-fashioned skeleton key from the outside. Ada hesitated, but then decided, feeling guilty, that it would be best and safest for David if she did so that day, and every day thereafter. She had not told anyone about David's recent wanderings. She feared they would take him away. After her school day ended, she raced home, hoping desperately that he had neither broken out nor panicked, that she would not find him reduced to tears on the floor, or find him in some other equally upsetting position. But he seemed fine, sitting placidly in his chair by the window, gazing out of it. In the ensuing weeks, Ada attempted to extract all the information she could before it faded. But he grew more and more reticent.
I simply can't remember, my dear, he said tiredly.
So instead, she wrote down memories that he had at one time or another shared with her, to the best of her memory. That her grandfather was the grandson of Finnish immigrants who made their money upon arriving in the United States in shipping, and that her grandmother was a descendant of William Bradford, the British separatist, the Mayflower passenger, the governor of Plymouth Colony. That his mother's maiden name was Amory. All of this Ada wrote down in a blue-covered notebook, separate from the marbled ones in which David wrote his assignments. When she asked him to confirm what she had written, reading the facts aloud, he told her that he could not recall.
Amory? He said to her. I've never heard of it.
Ada called this period in David's life working from home, to preserve her sense of hope and his sense of dignity, and each day she set out some task for him to complete. And on weekends she brought home several newspapers and pored over them with him. He became increasingly obsessive about Elixir. Interacting with it seemed to be the only thing that brought him solace anymore. Sometimes when he had trouble finding the words, he simply pointed to the office, and then she walked him into it and sat him down at his computer. She opened Elixir for him and left the room out of respect and let him type.
Now you,
he told her when he had finished,
and it occurred to her that perhaps he had the conviction that Elixir was his legacy. She signed him out, signed herself in. Dutifully, she conversed with the machine. Sometimes she still tried to encourage him to focus on his work, but mainly he just sat in front of it, looking at it silently for long stretches of time, a puzzled, painful look on his face. Sometimes she brought out the floppy disk he had given her one August night 2 years prior, at the end of his failed dinner party. "For Ada" was still marked upon its hardcover, in David's handwriting. A note from him to Ada was still affixed to the disk itself. She inserted it into the disk drive. Then she sat down with David in front of it and asked him to help her solve it. "DHARSNE, LXRHQH, LTWJ, FOLKTWD, URSZJZC, MILW, FTALVUH, VZRD, LDEYIXQ. Read the text file. It looked completely arbitrary. David was quiet at these times, watching as she wrote down on pieces of paper in front of her the letters that appeared before her on the screen. As she tallied their frequency, made slash marks above them on the page. One day, Ada turned the computer on, and it displayed an icon of a frowning, X-eyed monitor, and would not boot up at all. David pointed at the computer screen.
"Just like me," he said, about the sad little Mac on the screen.
And Ada laughed in relief that he could still make a joke. She vowed to fix the computer, but she couldn't.
"Time for Elixir?"
David asked daily. He had retained the word surprisingly well, and she had to tell him that his Mac was broken and bring him upstairs to use hers instead. While he worked, she tried and tried in his office to fix whatever was preventing his computer from starting. In light of David's illness, the state of the machine took on greater meaning. But she couldn't. She needed David's help, and he could no longer give it. At the time of David's retirement, the lab was working on a system to increase Elixir's vocabulary by training outsiders to chat with it correctly, which David had always been opposed to. Liston, the new director, discussed the lab's progress with Ada in bits and pieces each time she saw her. Prior to the onset of David's disease, she had always seemed hesitant to involve Ada in the work of the lab, not because she doubted her ability to learn it, but because long ago, she had unofficially designated herself a counterbalance to David in regard to Ada's well-being, and as such pushed her gently backward into childhood to the best of her ability while he beckoned her forth. Now that David was fading, however, Liston seemed to realize how much Ada missed the work and included her in it whenever she could. She came over for dinner once a week, sometimes bringing Maddie, her youngest, when she could convince him to come along. He read comic books in a corner, looking at all of them suspiciously from time to time, not saying much. Other times she came alone, and she updated Ada on the work of the lab, the problems they'd encountered, the tangles they were working out. Ada sometimes tried to help remotely, presenting her findings to Liston the next time she saw her or spoke to her, once calling the lab with a solution that had presented itself to her suddenly in the middle of the previous sleepless night.
"Thank you so much, honey," said Liston,
and Ada heard in her voice that they had fixed it themselves already. At school, Ada was distracted. She had settled into a painful, uncomfortable existence at Queen of Angels. She rarely spoke, except when directly called upon. Not wanting to ask David to buy her a backpack, and properly humiliated out of ever using a briefcase again, she settled on simply carrying her books in her arms every place she went, which earned her odd glances and several nicknames that she overheard, despite her best efforts to tune out every conversation around her. She had no friends,
nor had she any enemies, really. She brought a novel to lunch each day, balanced at the top of the stack of her school books, and read it while she ate slowly, neatly, making certain with searching hands that she had wiped her mouth clean after every bite. Simultaneously, she felt invisible and too observed, and she fantasized at times about what it would be like to be amorphous, incorporeal, the manifestation of the vision she had had upon leaving the Steiner lab for the final time. A shadow girl, who could slip imperceptibly around corners and through hallways, keeping close to the wall. She existed, but was not seen. In the privacy of her room, under cover of night, she sometimes practiced mannerisms and dialect that she had seen children her own age using. Like, she whispered to herself. Totally, whatever. She longed now to be pretty. After weighing the evidence, she had recently decided that she was not, which in her former life would not have mattered. In fact, David had always seemed to consider prettiness a detriment, something hampering and debilitating, like a tin can tied to one's leg. But at Queen of Angels, prettiness was all. Melanie McCarthy was the standard bearer in this realm, and everyone else in the eighth grade could be ranked in descending order after her. Ada was, she felt sure, near the bottom. In the mirror, she took off her glasses, and her reflection became hazier, softer, better. She put them back on and frowned. The glasses themselves, she thought, were maybe the problem. But to ask David for contacts would be unthinkable, akin to asking him for something like breast implants. She went to bed, sighing long sighs, dreading the morning. As David's mental decline accelerated, Ada clung to his physical presence in the house and dreaded the day when he would not be there. She reverted to an old pattern. When Liston came over for dinner now, she worked her hardest to convince her that he was well, that his mind was sharper than it was, his memory more capable. She coached him on topics of conversation in advance, went over the day's headlines with him, as she used to do herself before the dinner parties he once threw. "David was just saying," she would begin, and then dispense an opinion that she herself had constructed after a careful perusal of world events. "Right, David?" she asked him, and he would look at Ada vaguely and nod. He had always been kind to Maddie, and he continued to be so. When it occurred to him, he gave Maddie some little token each time he came over, a book or a fancy pen or a piece of chocolate. Sometimes the chocolate was too old, and Ada had to swap it out for something else, but mostly Maddie didn't notice. With time, though, David forgot Maddie's name, and then forgot him altogether. "Who's this young fellow?" he began to ask, and Maddie seemed terrified of him, avoiding his gaze, finally refusing to come altogether. Liston didn't tell Ada this, but she knew it to be true. Liston protected her. "He's got baseball practice in the evening now," she told Ada. "William takes him over." The rest of the members of the lab stopped by from time to time at first, but soon their visits dwindled in frequency, and now when David forgot their names, it made Ada perversely satisfied. If they came more, she thought, he'd know them better. Still, she prompted him, wanting them to think well of him and of her, too, cheerily glossing over the extent of his deterioration. When Regina O'Brien came for her monthly visit, she employed the same techniques. At the end of each visit, she took Ada into another room and asked if she felt comfortable living in the home. And she always, always said yes. For a time it seemed to be working. Ada felt she could take care of her father. Sometimes when he fell asleep at his desk or in his chair, a book in his hand unread, Ada sat across from him and imagined him back to his previous state.
imagined that when he woke he would spring up vigorously from his chair and beckon her into the dining room and lay out before her some famous proof or problem and set her to work upon it, spinning her like a top.
"Very good, Ada," he used to tell her when she solved it. "Excellent work. Smart girl," he would say.
Benedictions that she craved now, beyond all measure. "Well done," she whispered to herself at times, when she solved a problem that she'd assigned herself, from the notebooks David, in his former incarnation, had created for her. "Well done, you clever girl," and she imagined that David was saying it. She got by in this way. She managed. She vowed to keep up the charade of David's competence for as long as she could. And then, in May, David walked out of his room without his clothes on, which mortified Ada to the point of incapacitation.
"Get dressed,"
she said abruptly, and then she ran and hid in her bedroom. When she emerged, he had thankfully complied. But he did this with some frequency thereafter, until she began to lay out his clothes for day and night upon his bed, ordering him to get into them when it was time, and closing his bedroom door behind her while he did so.
"Are you dressed?"
she asked him, and only when he replied affirmatively did Ada enter. Often he grew frustrated as he searched for words.
"The thing that's like a wrench, but not a wrench," he said. "The thing that's black and small. The thing that you use. The thing that I love."
And then, when thing eluded him,
"I want it. Where is it?"
There were times where she could not help. Next, he began to swear at her. She had steeled herself for this, having read several scholarly articles that indicated that the aphasia associated with Alzheimer's often left one's arsenal of curses, located in a different region of the brain, unaffected. But the reality of it shocked her. Gentle David, calling her words that he had never before even used in her presence. David, who deplored cursing. He knew her less and less, sometimes raising a fist at her as if in anger and then letting it drop to his side. Sometimes weeping like a small child, which troubled her soul.
"My friend,"
he said by then about all people in order to avoid their names, including his own daughter. "Ada," she sometimes said in response. In front of Liston, she pretended it did not bother her, but in private she railed at him from time to time.
"You know my name,"
she said to him testily, and once or twice she had yelled at him with her full voice.
"I'm Ada," she had said. "You named me Ada."
She had never before shouted at him, and it felt terrible and thrilling all at once. In those moments, he blinked at her. He did not flinch. He seemed aware, somehow, of the importance of keeping his pride intact, a citadel, as his mental faculties crumbled around it. And as Ada wailed at him, shouting her own name, he would turn his head slowly to some nearby object and gaze upon it. Other times she whispered it to him, her name, imagining somehow that it might seep into his consciousness subliminally. While he was sleeping, while he was awake and staring blankly out a window onto Shawmut Way. "I'm your daughter, Ada." He did not respond. More and more every week he tried to wander. The bells went off in the middle of the night. She leapt from her bed. She grew weary. One day, Ada came home from school to find three large fire trucks lined up along Shawmut Way. Liston, in her work clothes, stood outside of David's house, speaking to a firefighter. Their neighbors stood nearby in little groups. Even Mrs. O'Keefe had gotten up out of her lawn chair for the occasion, was leaning on her cane, straining to overhear what they were saying. It was then that Ada saw David, sitting on the ground, a blanket wrapped around him despite the warm weather. A firefighter was sitting next to him casually, attempting to chat with him as he sat there on the grass. He looked childlike and confused. A 5-year-old waiting for his mother. His feet were pointed upward toward the sky. His head hung low, and he was shaking it almost imperceptibly from side to side. In the spring air, Ada picked up the smell of something acrid. Smoke, she realized. Her instinct in that moment was to run. But then Liston turned and saw her and strode toward her quickly.
Ada, she said. Honey, did you lock him inside? Was David locked inside every day?
Ada felt something rising up inside her. It was the unfairness of it all. Of being expected to watch over David, who was supposed to be watching over her. She felt simultaneously ashamed and self-righteous.
What else was I supposed to do?
She wanted to ask Liston. Her father was her responsibility, not anybody else's. And she had made the best decision she could make. But she could not articulate any of this, for her voice had been taken from her. Instead, she stood in place, looking down, her arms folded tightly about her waist, waiting for someone, anyone, to recognize the injustice of it all. Until at last, Liston put an arm around her and led her down the street. St. Andrew's Manor was in Quincy, just outside the city. It was a nice place overseen by an order of nice nuns. Liston's own mother had ended her days there after a debilitating stroke. Shortly after the day that David almost set the house on fire, as it turned out, a neighbor had heard the sound of the smoke detector going off for too long and had called the fire department. Liston had had a serious conversation with Ada. And at last, Ada gave her consent. David would no longer live with Ada on Shawmut Way. Liston, as previously agreed, would assume full guardianship of Ada, who at 14 was 4 years from legal adulthood. And David would move into St. Andrews. When Ada first heard the name of the place, she thought it might be something fancy. A country house with a semicircular driveway and a stable, a Tudor mansion set back in the woods. Liston said that all David would need were some clothes, maybe some pictures to put on his shelves. At which point Ada realized that they had no pictures, nothing they kept in frames around the house. Liston's house, on the other hand, was decorated almost exclusively with photographs of her sons and daughter and her grandson, or friends of hers with Liston at the beach, or family. She even had pictures of Ada in the lab on Halloween at their Christmas parties. Shyly, Ada asked her if she might take one of these to bring along with David so that he would be able to remember her. They had almost no pictures in their home. David's camera shyness meant there were none of him, and he rarely thought to take a picture of Ada.
"Of course, baby," said Liston. "I think that's a really good idea."
And she brought Ada over to her house and let her choose any one that she wanted. After some consideration, Ada selected one from a photo album, perhaps 3 years old. In it, Ada was sitting at the monitor in the main room of the lab, chatting with Elixir, smiling happily toward the camera, but looking up above it, for she remembered it was David she'd been looking at. David, who had been standing behind Liston as she took the shot, saying something silly about formaggio or fromage. Liston selected a few more and said she would find frames for them all. And then she put a hand on Ada's shoulder. "It'll be okay, kiddo," she said. Ada looked up at her warm face and wanted badly to smile for her, but she found that she couldn't. The morning of David's departure, he seemed more confused than usual. He hardly spoke. Ada and Liston had spent the previous evening packing his clothes into a large suitcase, and beholding it, David put one hand to his cheek plaintively.
"But where are we going?"
he said, over and over again.
"We're moving," said Liston. "Someplace great. An adventure." "No, thank you,"
he said politely at one point. Just before David walked out the kitchen door for the last time, Ada had the urge suddenly to tell him to look around the house once more, to go down into the basement, to place a hand on his work desk, to go up into the hot and dusty attic, to go and sit on his old bed for a while. Did he know that this would be his last glimpse of the house he had grown to love? But Liston was guiding him out the door already, perhaps to avoid upsetting him.
"Where are we going now?" asked David, one last time.
"Put your seatbelt on, honey," Liston said to David. He complied, and then let his arms fall limply at his sides. From her place in the back seat, Ada gazed at his hands. In the left one, he was clutching his lucky charm, a clover-shaped trinket he usually carried with him. Recently, it had comforted her to see him holding it. At least, she'd been telling herself, he remembered to put that in his pocket each day. But that day, it pained Ada to see it, bespeaking as it did some unfulfilled wish. His hands around it, looking doughy, inflated somehow, too large for his body. They didn't look like the hands of a working man. Nothing like David's strong hands as they flew about at one time, dismantling things, reconstructing them, chopping and stirring his meals. Recently, she thought. Less than 2 years ago.
"What sort of place is this?" David was saying. "And tell me the name again?"
"St. Andrew's Manor," said Ada, hoping that the sound of the name would please him, Manor being a word that she imagined might have similar connotations for him as it did for her.